Just something for you to read and to consider just for a moment. This is the title for today because we're looking at the tenants in the vineyard. But I think it's a little bit misnamed. Okay? Just have a look at this. God sometimes blesses a poor exegesis of a bad translation, of a doubtful rendering, of an obscure verse, of a minor prophet. That, of course, whoever wrote it or said it was aiming it at folk like me and any others who would dare to stand up and speak to others. But the key to that little quote is the word sometimes. God does not condone idleness or anything that will think that'll do. The word is sometimes because it's an indication that God is very gracious. Sometimes we'll use things that probably we wouldn't expect him to use. Let me introduce you to this gentleman. Some of you will know who he is. Gerald Coates, familiar to you? Gerald was the founder of the Pioneer Group of Churches, very much a media person, an excellent communicator. I don't know what his early church, denominational, whatever it was, involved, but I do remember him saying on one occasion that speakers' sermons were classified in three different ways. They were either good, they were sound, or they were deep. And when people said them, they said it with the usual look on their face and the shake of the head to say what their words weren't saying. I guess it's a little bit better than poor, bad, doubtful, or obscure, isn't it? But he said, once you had learned to interpret the designations that people put on sermons, they went like this. Good meant it was good for someone else, but they weren't there. Sound meant it was boring, but it was biblical. And deep, I didn't understand a word of it. I'll try to avoid all of them this morning, if I may. I wonder what might be the designation for the parable that we're looking at today. We're going to read it collectively, if we may. And it's taken from Luke's Gospel. It's in two other Gospels as well, but this is Luke 20. And let's read it together, shall we? And he began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and let it out to tenants and went into another country for a long while. When the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but they also beat and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. He sent yet a third. This one they wounded and cast out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him. But when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, this is the heir. Let us kill him, so that the inheritance may be ours. And they threw him out the vineyard and killed him. What then will the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, surely not. But he looked directly at them and said, what then is that that is written? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. The scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them. but they feared the people. Right, this morning we begin with the vineyard and we end with communion. I thought that was appropriate because I don't think even three choirs could manage that one. So if you're a visitor, by the way, three choirs is a vineyard a few miles away. If you're visiting with us, we have been going through a series relating to the parables. And as you'll appreciate, there are a lot of them. We haven't done them in a particular order, but we've reached the one about the vineyard today. With certain things in the New Testament, if it's the letters, for instance, Paul's letters or whoever, the legitimate approach is to ask who wrote them, who they wrote them to, why they wrote them, and what did the hearers understand from what was being read to them. When it comes to the parables, we have to ask legitimately what's being said, who is it being said to, and where is it being said, and why is it being said anyway? An indication of the importance of the one that we read together earlier is that with certain variations, it appears in three Gospels altogether, which is an indication of its importance. We don't need to ask who the speaker is, because it is always in the Gospels Jesus. Before and after. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple, up there, it's up there somewhere. Nope. We've seen him before. Yeah, that's the one. Thank you. One day Jesus was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel. The chief priests and the scribes with the elders came. After this, the scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them. He begins in the temple precincts addressing the people. That would be anyone who would come to listen. But there are others with doubtful motives that are listening in. These are the kind of first century media trolls, the ones who are looking for anything to pin on somebody that they had accused them for. They are nasty and they are vindictive. Nothing seems to have changed very much in the last 2,000 years. They're looking for anything that can be twisted to suit their own agenda. Something, anything by which they can accuse Jesus. But there's another dimension here. It's where it's been said, which is a crucial part. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple, the where, as well as the what, has to be taken into account. And as he was teaching daily in the temple, the chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him. Because this is not only a sacred site, as far as they're concerned, but it's a symbol of their power. The temple and the temple precincts is something that they felt they had an ownership of. And along with their traditions, the temple had become an idol. You don't have to read very far in another gospel, so shortly after this, where Jesus passes judgment on it and says not one stone will be left upon another. But there's a further dimension. What's gone on before it? To put it into some sort of context, what preceded this? It occurs following the triumphal entry, what we now call conveniently Palm Sunday, which was followed by the cleansing of the temple. And following the cleansing of the temple, Jesus said this, "It is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. And you can imagine who is listening and the effect that will have on what they're hearing. This has rattled a few cages for a few people. Well, for a lot of people. In Matthew, in Mark, and Luke's gospel, this is the first public response from the temple leaders. This is the first time it's been noted that they have turned up together to see him. This is what we know as the Sanhedrin, the delegation of chief priests, the scribes, the elders. These are the people who rule the roost. It's composed of these three types of people. And this, the fact that they have turned up to hear what he's saying, is an indication of just how serious the whole thing is, or that they're taking it very seriously. Let's just go to the parable. Because each stanza of this parable, each few lines, begins with that the owner sent a servant, then he sent another servant, and he sent yet a third servant. And each time it concludes with them being beaten and sent away empty-handed, and each time they are treated more harshly. The scenes that this parable conjures up in the minds of the people listening are the various times in the Old Testament, which many of them will be familiar, where the prophets are sent to Israel and the treatment that they received. If you remember Jeremiah, they threw him down a well. They had to go and fish him out again. They treated them badly. Listen to what Jesus says in Matthew 23. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. Parables are very direct. Yes, they are couched in a certain type of language, but they are very direct. They can sometimes build to a climax and the punchline comes right at the end, but this one is the exception. And although it seems as if it's at the end, it is not. It's not in the question and the reply that comes in verses 15 and 16, and they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him, and when the owner of the vineyard, what will he do? You know the reply and the response. The climax of this parable comes in the middle, or pretty near to it. And it's the decision that is taken by the owner that is the crux of the whole thing. What, says the owner, shall I do? Is he going to allow his enemies to dictate his response? Is he going to allow those who hate him, who have killed his servants? Is he going to allow them to dictate how he behaves? And then he says, I'll send my son. They respect him. And that's a decision that seems either naive or just sheer lunacy. I think it was Martin Luther who once reputedly said, if the world had done to me what it's done to God, I'd have kicked it to bits a long time ago. And we can understand that. I mean, this guy has been treated abominably in the parable. There's a word that I came across recently. Macrothymia. It's an interesting word. It simply means he put away his anger. Anger that would, in human terms, seem quite legitimate. But he puts away his anger. It's a deliberate response to make himself vulnerable in the face of violence and provocation. You may remember a couple of times when Saul was pursuing David. There was a real hate thing going on, at least with Saul toward David. And on two occasions, David had Saul at his mercy, once in a cave and once while he was sleeping. Once he could have knifed him in the back, and the other one he could have driven him through with a spear, and he didn't. He practiced makrothymia. He put away his anger and practiced instead this generosity of spirit towards someone that was hating him. The parable of the great banquet, where somebody decides to hold a great banquet and the invitations have gone out. It is lavish, but it's undeserved hospitality, and it is rejected. When the servants go out to say, come on, everything is ready, come on, come and enjoy it, they all, one by one, begin to make some of the most banal excuses you've ever come across. Like, I've married a wife. I bought a piece of land, but I haven't even seen it yet. You know, they're a little bit silly. But no revenge is exacted on the ungrateful, but grace is extended instead to the unworthy. He sends out the servants again. He says, just bring people in, anybody. Bring them in so that my banquet can be full. He put away his anger. And instead, he extended the hospitality and the love. There's the old saying, isn't it, that you fight fire with fire, which is a daft thing to do, because all you finish up with is a bigger fire and it doesn't solve anything. I like the one, I think it was Gandhi, who said, if we take an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, before long the whole world will be blind and toothless. That's what revenge does. Revenge means that you become the object of revenge. The owner's response to what he has undergone because of these tenants seems outrageously stupid. And yet, you take into account what Paul says sometime later, for the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. It's not an eye for an eye. It's not fighting fire with fire. It's using weapons that can destroy the strongholds that are facing you. Two issues arise in this, and this is the rent and the tenancy, the inheritance, sorry. The renters, or the tenants, are refusing to pay rent in kind. Remember the way the parable goes? He sends his servants to get some of the produce. Now, it may be just an annual thing. It seems that if it might be, it didn't all happen in the same year. And they're ignored. There is a major work by Jewish rabbis called the Mishnah. It was written in the 2nd and 3rd century, and it contains a written collection of Jewish oral teaching. And there's something in it that speaks specifically to this situation. Title, another word for ownership, by usucaption. That's a good word, isn't it? I'd struggle with that one. Usucaption. To houses, cisterns, trenches, vaults, dovecots, bathhouses, olive presses, irrigated fields and slaves, and aught that brings constant gain is secured by occupation during 3 completed years. Usucaption is this. It's the acquisition of a title or right to property by uninterrupted and undisputed possession for a prescribed term. Take your mind away from that to the 21st century, and what do we call it? Squatter's rights. If you can prove you have been in this building for such a long time and nobody has interfered, you can have it. It's a daft law, but we've got it. But so did they. if they could stay there uninterrupted for 3 years, they could claim that the inheritance was theirs. What it does, it sheds some light on the mentality of the renters. If they could maintain uninterrupted possession for 3 years, then they had ownership. Hence, was it 3 years when the servants came and they killed them, and then the next year they came and they killed them? Might have been 3 years, I don't know, the parable doesn't say. But the renters forgot that they were renters, and they began to presume ownership. So to what does the inheritance refer? Some conclude that it's the land. Some conclude that it's the nation of Israel. That it's not a literal vineyard. Well, that becomes fairly obvious. And yet, the word vineyard is very often a synonym for Israel itself. And what's to be given to whom? The conflict is between Jesus and the temple leadership. These are the eavesdroppers. These are the ones that are listening in. And these are the ones that he finishes up addressing. The scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them, but they feared the people. It's on there somewhere, James. Something is to be taken from them and given to others. Israel's high priestly establishment controlled the institution that included and involved this set of buildings where Jesus was teaching. They felt that they were the custodians of that. They were owning it if nobody else interfered and got in the way. Some names that you'll be familiar with if you read a little further on in the Gospels is the name of Annas. Annas is one of the high priests. And he has five sons, each of whom become high priest in turn. I think it's what we call nepotism, isn't it? And then he has a son-in-law as well called Caiaphas. And these two turn up, don't they, at a very, very precarious point in the life and very near to the death of Jesus. Because it's in their vested interest to keep this thing, because this is what is being challenged. Jesus' words are now directed against the temple leadership. And that's why they want rid of him. This building, everything that it represents, the people that come here, they are ours. They are our inheritance. And we will not have it challenged. But there's something bigger, something far bigger at stake. Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruits. The kingdom of God will be taken away from you. They didn't want to hear that. Something bigger. Something bigger than land. Something bigger than temples. Something bigger than their ethnicity or their race. And yet they would settle, according to the parable, for a few measly bunches of grapes. This is a kingdom, the kingdom of God, that acknowledges all ethnicities. And acknowledges them as equal. Whatever the colour of the skin, whatever the language they speak, whatever the culture that they have come from. As Paul quotes, there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female. This is a kingdom that embraces all cultures, all races, all ethnicities, and yet at the same time it transcends and it exceeds them all. Because these are a people who are the kingdom of God. and they're going to lose them. As citizens of that kingdom, we celebrate one, and we have already sung a number of words this morning that re-echo the very thing that I've been saying. For one who out of his mercy and for our sakes put away his anger. We began, did we not? I turned my eyes to Calvary, where Jesus died, what? For a temple? For a Sanhedrin? Where Jesus died for me. A place where he set aside his anger that legitimately he could have exercised, but he didn't. We celebrate this morning as a loyal, faithful body of subjects of the kingdom of God in a celebration of generous, undeserved inheritance. We simply call it communion. But let's remember, we are celebrating something far bigger than this. Far bigger. Far more important. Far more significant. Because this is part and parcel of us being the kingdom of God that none of us deserve at all.